Take me where the promises are real.
Let's have an AA meeting. My name's Tim Orr, and I'm an alcoholic. Welcome to the Monday Night Blue Chip Speakers Meeting on NavaZoom. Where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more of sobriety tells his or her story. This reading is based on a passage from page 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual in our personal stories describes in their own language and from their own point of view the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and a clear-cut idea of what has happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our NavaZoom room tonight and listening later on AABlueChipSpeakers.org desperately in need will hear tonight's speaker. And we believe it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I'm one of them too. I must have this thing. We had another speaker scheduled for tonight, and there's an illness involved, and I got the call, and one of the first things I did was, well, I called my sponsor. And then I contacted our friend Tinsley. Tinsley said, well, I got an idea, maybe. We'll see what happens. And just a little while later, I got a text that said, a little birdie told me you needed a backup speaker. For you, Tim, anything. Yes, I'll do it. And so with that, I'm going to put our little birdie on for a second to introduce our speaker.
All right. My name is Little Birdie, and I'm an alcoholic. No, I'm Tinsley. I'm an alcoholic. And, we're taught in this program to, when people ask for, Tinsley, alcoholic here. And, Julie immediately said yes when asked to be of service tonight. And that's what we're taught about to do in these rooms. And that's kind of where the rubber meets the road. We hear a lot in the rooms about, doing the deal. And she's probably going to tell you what her deal is, but my perception of the deal is people who do the deal in the rooms are people who participate and help facilitate the meetings and sponsor people and have a sponsor and work the steps, learn to pray, and work with others and have fun in recovery. That's my perception of doing the deal. I'm sure she's going to touch on all those points. Now I've heard her tell her story many times in person. I don't think I've heard her do it on Zoom yet. I may be wrong, but I don't think I've heard her do it. So I'm really looking forward to it. And with that, I give you Julie.
All right.
Thank you, Tinsley. And thank you, Tim, for thinking of me. I didn't think I would tell my story on Zoom because I didn't think it would be very natural. But this Zoom format has become sort of a natural habitat for me now. And so I guess it was destiny. I am Julie. I'm an alcoholic, and but because I'm an alcoholic, I am also a lot of other things. And hopefully, my story will explain that. I am also a mother, a wife, a sister, an employee, a taxpayer, a homeowner, a vehicle owner, a pet owner, a responsible member of society, a volunteer in my community, and I have a full and delightful life now because I'm an alcoholic. And that may sound weird, but it's because if I hadn't found the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, I wouldn't have found a way of living which has catapulted me into the fourth dimension, right? A way of living that has allowed me to grow and learn and become an adult the way I was supposed to from the get-go, but got sidetracked because of my alcoholism. But the alcoholism brought me here, which brought me to a higher power, which has brought me a full life. So let me start off by giving you some of my statistics. My birthday is May 23rd, 1961, which makes me 59 years old. I will also do all the math for you because I am a kind soul. And so I'm 59 years old. I had my first drink in October of 1979 when I was 18 years old. It was a legal age at the time, and I was in college. My sobriety date is February 25th, 1995. So that means if I stay sober through February of the next year, I will have 26 years, which means that I have been sober 10 years longer than I drank, which is just mind-boggling to me. But I like telling my story because I like to have that part of my life, the what it was like, front and center, so that when my good life gets too good, I don't forget how it could be at any time if I go back to active drinking. So I want to read one of some of my favorite stuff. But I mean, I could start reading and never stop, but I promise I won't read you the whole big book. But I am going to read you a few paragraphs and, you know, kind of explain to you why I'm reading it. But this is from page 84. It says, "And we have ceased fighting anything or anyone, even alcohol. For by this time, sanity will have returned. We will seldom be interested in liquor. If tempted, we will recoil from it as from a hot flame. We react sanely and normally, and we will find that this just happened automatically. We will see that our new attitude toward liquor has been given us without any thought or effort on our part. It just comes. That is the miracle of it. We are not fighting it, nor are we avoiding temptation. We feel as though we had been placed in a position of neutrality, safe and protected. We have not even sworn off. Instead, the problem has been removed. It does not exist for us. We are neither cocky nor are we afraid. That is our experience. That is how we react so long as we keep in fit spiritual condition." And I read that because that's what I came into Alcoholics Anonymous for. I needed to stop drinking. I went to stop drinking and I didn't want it to control my life anymore. But I had gotten this and so much more, you know, so much more. The idea that I don't ever think about alcohol anymore, drinking it, it's stunning. It's like that saying that we hear in here, miracle's not that I don't drink, it's that I don't want to drink. I don't even think about it. It's not part of my life. And I'll give you an example of how I finally realized that I was here at this point. And it was really, you know, just, I don't know, probably seems like it was just a couple years ago, but gosh, it's probably going on 10 years now. But my husband is not one of us, right? He drinks a beer a week. You know, I mean, it's ridiculous. But so for Christmas one year, about 10 years ago, he asked me for something very specific. He asked for a home brew kit to brew his own beer, right? And I, you know, it was so interesting because my first thought was not, you know, oh my God, I can't be in the same house with a home brew kit. You know, I might drink it. I wasn't afraid. My first thought was not, you know, that son of a bitch, I'm trying to recover from alcoholism. How does he, you know, why does he ask for this for Christmas? It was neither of those two things. I'm totally embarrassed to tell you that my very first thought with that ask for a beer kit was, oh great, we're going to get ants. Because what I didn't even think about it being alcohol or that it being a part of my life. Not at all. You hear my phone, that somebody's calling for political reasons, I'm sure. So I mean, that is the description of this paragraph that I just read to you. I didn't even think about alcohol at that moment. Not at all. And so I want to tell you how I got there I want to tell you where I was and how I got there. I was, just sort of the very high level background is I am the last child of my parents and I was born in Memphis, Tennessee, as I said, in 1961. I'm the last of five surviving children. There were six total children. But my older brother died in infancy. Of course, I didn't know him because I was the last. But we had an idyllic childhood, really. And, you know, I knew my whole life that my parents drank. And I, you know, for when I was young, it just was part of who they were. I mean, it was very, you know, 1960s, very Mad Men kind of thing. Everybody drank. but we lived in Memphis, and they had moved there. They were not Southerners, and it was an interesting place to live in 1961. We were there in 1968, so it was a pretty volatile place to be. But, you know, I was a child, so I didn't really pick up on a lot of that. But anyway, we ended up moving to Tampa, Florida in 1972. My two older sisters were already out of the house. And so really, the people who moved to Tampa really moved there and ended up having to go to school there were my sister Nina and my brother John and me. And my two older sisters were already in college or off doing their thing. So my dad was a surgeon, but he was more of a teaching professor. So he was always associated with a school of surgery somewhere. We moved to Tampa for him to be the chairperson of surgery at USF. And we were there for 10 years. So that's how I got to be in Florida. And I grew up there and had, you know, great place to grow up. I lived on a lake. But my parents' alcoholism was definitely accelerating. And that's when I began to notice it, and I began to see it having some detrimental effects on my parents and therefore on me, you know. I said that I was an alcoholic. I am a pure alcoholic. I'm the only person my age that I know who's never done any drugs whatsoever. And you know, I definitely don't apologize for that when I'm telling my story in an AA meeting. But I've never done any of those things, and it's a long story, but you know, I was afraid to do it. Let's put it that way. My brother had gotten very ill, and one of the things, mentally ill, very quickly, very like overnight, mentally ill. And one of the things that the doctor said was that there are some people who can smoke marijuana like just once or twice, and it changes their brain chemistry. And he was 15, and he had a complete and total mental breakdown. So that was just something I picked up on. They never confirmed that that's what happened to him, but they said that was one of the things that could happen to you. So I was 13, so I was like, I'm not doing that. That's scary. So that's how I managed to go to the University of Florida in 1979 and stick with the alcohol and never drink. So I want to talk about that a little bit. Yes, because my mother was, well, both of them were very bad alcoholics. In high school, I was very anti-alcohol. I was like the Carrie Nation of my high school. You know, I really thought you were a real loser if you drank. And so I never drank. I was anti-alcohol. But then I got to the University of Florida. I was of legal age, and I was a freshman. And like I said, in October of 1979, I was in my dorm room, and we were planning on going out with a group of girls. My friend Amory Garrity showed up in the dorm room with a bottle of vodka and a bottle of orange juice. And I'm sitting at my makeup mirror, putting on my makeup, and she pours me a screwdriver. And I take one or two sips of that. And man, I'm telling you, I found my magic potion. And I could not believe how great that made me feel. I relaxed. I had no idea I was such a wound tight human being. No idea. I fell in love instantly, and I believe it or not, I have pictures. I want to show you. And when Garrity showed up, I was putting on my makeup. We were going to go out to a bar, and then we were going to go to a fraternity party. And I don't know if you can see it. Can you see it? Can you see me? Nod your heads if you do. I'm in the purple or the pink. And that's Emory looking at me like, this is 30 minutes after my first drink, y'all. And I'm already laughing my ass off, right? This is not the person that I was 30 minutes before that. Right? Is that too close, not close enough? Somebody tell me if you can see it. Okay, it's good. All right, that's 30 minutes. Like I said, we then went to a bar and then went to a fraternity party. This is about 2.5 hours later. It's going downhill rapidly, right? Okay, this is the same night. First night I ever drank. I was in heaven. I mean, this is kind of fun doing it on film. You can show these pictures. And I think about those pictures all the time because I remember the release. I remember just, I am beautiful. I am funny. I'm the world's best, right? And very rapid. Absolutely, I drank. I mean, I drank alcohol from the get-go. So I tell you that because I believe it's hereditary, because I was anti-alcohol 1 minute before I drank it, and then I was pro-alcohol. So I don't think that you can get there that quickly mentally unless you have a physical problem with it. And so that's why I think it's hereditary. But, you know, my older sister is an alcoholic. Many of you know her, and she grew into her alcoholism. I mean, she just started drinking. She hated it. Well, it's not her story. It's mine. But anyway, so I went on to college. I kept going to college. I was a journalism major. I did very well in college, but every time I drank to get drunk. And there were many, many incidences where I shouldn't have made it home. I shouldn't have driven. I shouldn't have showed my face in public. I made myself, you know, this guy here was my best friend's older brother. He, you know, had to have pledges driving home all the time. I was constantly, you know, the mess in the back, right? And one night I remember early on they were having a big party, and they would put grain alcohol in big trash cans with grape juice or grape juice. And I mean, they would make it in like giant, the trash cans that we have like at NABA, you know, and there was a ladle hanging on the side of it. And I remember that night, I mean, first couple ones, I'm using the ladle, but by the end of the night, I'm literally sticking my whole arm into it because as if I can't get enough into the cup, you know, and my arm was purple up to here. I'm not kidding. And I mean, it was an ugly night that night. I mean, ugly. And, I mean, my friend's brother was coming to, there really is alcohol in there, you know, and the joke is they put that grain in there so the girls will drink it and they won't know it. He's actually telling me, stop, stop. They never told the sorority girls, stop drinking. They told me to stop many times. But I didn't. I ended up graduating. I ended up being very active on campus, but I kind of knew that it just felt like there was something different about me. I don't know. A lot of my friends, they drank, but I don't know. I don't think they felt the way I felt about it. I graduated. My parents moved to Atlanta my senior year in college. So I was joking. They moved away from me. They moved away from my hometown when I was a senior in college. And I pretty quickly moved to Tampa to start working. And I had a year in St. Petersburg, but then I moved to Tampa to work in my first corporate job. And, boy, I mean, it was high time. It was early 80s. We were all running around in our high heels and our little suits and, you know, being big shots. And, you know, I was doing very well in my career. I was on the fast track. I was told I was on the fast track. And I was getting lots of great assignments and doing a lot of fun things and flying all over the country and pretending to be an adult. But, man, I was using every opportunity to drink. And I started noticing that all my friends, we were drinking at happy hour after work in the bars downtown Tampa. But most of them eventually started, you know, getting boyfriends that were more serious, and then they, you know, get engaged. And, you know, eventually it was just me and whoever I could find, you know. And so I ended up more drinking by myself in my apartment. And, you know, there were just morally incomprehensible things happening. I really don't need to explain them. One night I picked up a guy at a bar, and it was a bar that was above some storefronts. So you had to go up a flight of stairs to get up to it. We fell down those wooden stairs, fell all the way down them from the top. And I was just only alive because I was drunk. And, you know, didn't freak out and start putting my arms out and stuff like that. And, you know, I think about that kind of thing, and I think about how I wanted to normalize it so badly that I remember after that particular incident calling up one of my girlfriends the next morning and saying to her, oh, it was so funny. You know, I ran into some guy or whatever, and I fell all the way down the stairs. I grabbed him. He fell with us. It was hysterical. And I remember the dead silence on the other end of the phone. Because there's just nothing funny about it. But if you know what I'm talking about, you know, we spin our stories. We put the PR zone on everything, you know. And, you know, it was like in my family, a lot of us were alcoholic, and my parents were. And I mean, I think the goal of every evening was to see I think my dad's goal really was to see which one of us he could make cry first, right? So, I mean, it wasn't a fun evening unless somebody was crying, you know. And yet every morning, one of us would call the other and go, "Wasn't dinner great at mom and dad's last night?" No, it sucked. We were crying and arguing and drunk, and it was ugly. There it was, and that's the way I always did everything. Am I still on? Can't tell if I'm freezing up. Okay. So, you know, my alcoholism progressed and progressed and progressed. And then I moved to Dallas with my company, and I pretty much hit bottom in Dallas. So this was 1980, the beginning of 1989, in fact. They were going to move me from Tampa to Dallas. It's just from one apartment to another. But anyway, my first day on the job of the new, it was the same company but a different division, that I had a new boss who was coming from the California office. We were all moving to Dallas start this new office. It was with GTE, which was what Verizon used to be. Okay. So we were the very first 18 people to move to Dallas for GTE, which is now a big, huge office of Verizon. And my new boss was coming from California, and the whole new team was meeting in California because we weren't ready to go to Dallas yet. I was supposed to fly to LA on, I think it was January 1st. But that, it was New Year's Eve. Long story short, I woke up on the day that I was supposed to go on the plane and go to LA for my very first day of my new big time job, to the sound of the taxi driver banging on the door. So I jump up, you know, I have barely packed, I've barely done anything, I certainly haven't taken a shower, so I'm throwing on, you know, old clothes, you know, just smell like, ugh. And I run down to the taxi, get in the car, in the over country flight from Tampa to LA, and arrive at my first day of my job, just like, what was that, you know? And it just didn't get any better from there. It just didn't get any better. I'd been seeing this guy in Tampa. He's not good for me, and yet I thought he was the be all to end all, of course. And anyway, he died that year suddenly, and then the job was not what I thought it was going to be, and the alcoholism was really, really bad. And you know, I got to the point where I was just in my apartment drinking a whole lot. And I have told this story so many times in a meeting, and I'll tell it now because it just symbolizes the feeling to me of being at the end of my drinking career and so isolated. Like I said, I was drinking pretty much every night. I would go to work, I would go home, go to the liquor store, go home, drink, pass out, wake up, go to work. This was, you know, I had no real life there in Dallas. Nothing was keeping me there other than the people that I worked with, some of whom are dear friends of mine still to this day. They saved my life. They really did. And anyway, I remember we were working late one night, and it was a Friday night, and we had to, we were out of the office. I think we were at a studio recording something. And I remember thinking, I wish we could quit. I want to go home. I want to go home and drink. It's, you know, I want to drink. But I wasn't thinking it was like, I want to drink. It was just, I want what I want, right? And I was getting crankier and crankier because what am I? I'm between drinks, right? And I somehow we ended up about 9:30 or 10 o'clock at night in a TCBY. They wanted to stop in and get to this new fangled concept of frozen yogurt coming out of the machine, right? So we go in there, and now it's been hours since my last drink, and I'm getting more and more restless, irritable, discontent. And we walk in, it is bright, and the parents and little kids are running around, and I'm like, it was like being slapped in the face. And I'm like looking around, and I make this really nasty comment. I say, "So this is what all the losers are doing on a Friday night." And I remember, it was God reminded me of that. I mean, God made me remember that, I think, because that was so sad. Because in my mind, all I wanted to do was go to my apartment and drink by myself. So I just, I sum up, and that, I don't have a huge drunkalog, you guys. I don't have wrecked cars and DUIs and screaming fits with, you know, divorces and all that. I have a sad, lonely woman who drank herself into that kind of nastiness, you know, just a nasty person. So that year fell apart, you know, based on a lot of other reasons, but also my alcoholism. And I ended up having to come back to jobless to Atlanta to live with my parents at 29 years old. And I don't recommend it, but I moved right in there. I moved right into their lifestyle and was drinking with them every night. And it was pretty sad and pretty pathetic. But lo and behold, a miracle did happen somewhere in there. I met a man who was the very first man who did not just leave after a few dates, right? Just kind of never call again kind of thing, which is, I had a lot of that. But he not only did not, he did not leave, he married me, and I am still married to that man. And I will tell you, I don't know what that means about him, but he married somebody who was way deep in her cups. So, you know, we can all psychoanalyze him later. I don't know what that means about him, but he didn't leave, and he probably should have, you know. I mean, I was just kind of overdressed. By that point, I was trying my hardest to be nasty to his family, you know. I pissed off all my family, and now I'm working on your family. I mean, it's just how we are, you know. And so what happened was, oh, goodness gracious, I talked so long. I was seeing a psychiatrist for depression because I was drinking massive doses of a depressant every night. But also I had depression. So one day I was in bed and I was not getting out of bed for work, and my husband was in the closet getting ready to leave for work. And I was moaning like, oh, I don't feel good, you know, pretty much every day, that same old thing. And he looked at me, I could see him in the closet, and he just turned and he screamed at me and he said, "For God's sake, get out of bed." And he grabbed his jacket and just left. And I was like, he had never yelled at me like that. And I rolled up in bed, and I just remember thinking, oh, God, help me. That afternoon, for some reason, I tell my psychiatrist, I'm an alcoholic. And you see this light bulb go off over her head. And she says, so lovely, I get chills. And she goes, well, you'd like to get some help with that, wouldn't you? And, of course, I burst into tears because I didn't think she was going to say that. I don't know what I thought she was going to say. Maybe I thought she was going to sign off on it. But I just went, I don't know. I don't know. I really don't know if I want help for this. But fast forward, she suggested I go to Ridgeview. I go to Ridgeview. I don't have time to tell this story, but basically I'm the only person I know that tried to make a reservation for Ridgeview. I thought it was like a spa. I didn't realize what it was. I thought it was a spa or something. And I mean, I went and I took their little test, and the lady goes, yeah, I think you should probably come here. And I said, okay, well, I've got to get some time off from work and I got to do this. And so I'll be here on February 25th. She goes, okay, like that. And I go, well, don't you need to write that down? And she goes, no, I don't. Craziest place of all time. So I showed up on February 25th because I said, I do what I say I'm going to do. You know, and I thought I was going to go somewhere where they were going to just tell me what was wrong with me and tell me how to drink. I had no idea the journey I was fixing to go on. But it was in there that I was given a big book. It was a soft cover big book, and I was probably day three in Ridgeview, and I got to the third step prayer. I was reading the book, and that sentence where it said, relieve me from the bondage of myself. I just went, and you know, I hadn't had that feeling since Anne-Marie Garrity brought the vodka in my dorm room, since that very first sip of vodka. That was the same feeling of just everything is going to be okay. It was like for 16 years, the wheel and the cog were just messed up, and then all of a sudden it just went, and it just snapped back in. I don't know how to explain it any other way. I just relaxed. And I haven't had a drink since. I just knew this was the easier, softer way. And I felt protected in a way that just like my first drink, I felt protected and that everything was going to be okay. And so I went off and started trying to work the program to the best of my ability. And I went into the evening program because I had a full-time job at Ridge Views. I can't remember how long that was, but for like months, from Monday through Friday, I had to leave work and go to Ridge View. And I was very lucky because I worked in Smyrna, of all places. So I was able to go there and then drive home every night. So I really was on, it helped me break the cycle of going to Greens every night and drinking and what have you. And, by this point I'm a newlywed. We got married. So, we got married when I was a drunk. Again, let's go a cycle and less him. And, I was 11 months married when I got sober. So, I started going to NABA. They said, go to meetings. I could continue to break that habit of going to Greens, and I met my sweet Princess Isla there, and everybody was so kind to me, and I was rough and obnoxious and knew everything and had it going on. And I remember, thinking that I was, all that in a pack of crackers in AA, and I was saying something in a meeting, and I was saying, I was pontificating at the 545 about how I had determined that I was an alcoholic and I had checked myself into Ridge View and I was doing this and I was doing that. And I just looked up and the 12 steps were on the wall behind the person who were behind the curtain, and they were on the wall. And I see this second step and it says, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. And I went, no, that's not right. I didn't do anything. That day when my husband yelled at me, I rolled over in bed and I said, God help me. And then that afternoon, I told my psychiatrist I was an alcoholic, and the ball started rolling toward my sobriety. So I realized at that very moment that I took a step two in that room at that moment. Even though I was doing everything and praying and all that, I didn't realize. To me, step two is giving credit where credit is due, right? Finally understanding that God was there the whole time. And that he, she, it deserve credit for where I am, that I didn't do any of this, none of it. The third step for me, I had to practice that, like I still do today, almost 26 years later, because I love to take my will back. It's my favorite thing to do. And I'm constantly reminded every day on how, I gotta just chill and let the world be the way it's supposed to be. A lot of great stories of how that came to be, for me. Some of them are too long to tell, but, it just grew into my third step, and I finally understood how to do it, sort of recognize that when I'm disturbed, and then say a prayer, just kind of just cut that disturbance in half if I possibly can. So I do that still to this day. And then I don't recommend this, but I just dragged my feet on step four. I just didn't want to do it. And I made a lot of excuses, including that I didn't know how to make columns in Microsoft Word. Therefore I couldn't do it, And I mean, I brought all of that to the 545. I mean, y'all were so patient. Oh my God. So patient. And, one day I was bitching about not wanting to do it. And, Donald Siegel said, see me after the meeting. And after the meeting, he said to me, Julie, just get a piece of paper. And at the top of it, write, God help me. Don't put columns down, just start writing. And I said, okay, I'll do that. And he had an 8-year sobriety at the time, and I thought he was a god, right? And I said, I just wish I had what you had. He goes, quit wishing for something you're never going to have. And I was like, oh, okay, stop, shining everything and just be you. So I did it. I did my four step. I had a sponsor, by the way, who I found at Ridge View, because I do have to tell you this. Right after I got sober and I got out of Ridge View, I'd been sober maybe 2 or 3 weeks, and it was a Friday night. And again, I was a newlywed. We didn't have kids. So my husband says, do you want to go to dinner? And I was like, go out to a restaurant. Oh, my God, how am I going to do that? I just thought, it's nighttime. You're in a restaurant. You've got to drink. That's what society people do. Like I ever drank society people. So we ended up going up to the Chili's at Tocco Hill, which is still there. And we walk in and we sit down. Or no, we go up to the hostess and she says, okay, well, it's going to be 5 minutes. And I just looked at the bar because, you know, for me, I don't have a job. I used to love it when there was a wait at a restaurant so we could go to the bar and pounce and drop alcohol before we went to the table because I was hoping people would stop counting at that point. Anyway, instead what we did, we sat down on that little wooden bench that's right there. And I call it like the principal's bench right outside the principal's office. And we sit down and I'm looking at the bar and I start crying. I'm crying. And my husband's like, do you want to leave? I'm like, no. Hostess is looking at me like, it's only 5 minutes. You don't need to cry about it. But we went and we stayed and, you know, we made it through. Anyway, I told that story at a meeting that was being held at Ridgeview, and my sponsor at the time cross-shared, thank God, and she said, well, no wonder you were crying. You've lost your best friend. I thought, this woman understands me. So I asked her, and she was so wonderful for me, and she took me through most of the steps all the way up through about step 8. So I took my 4-step to her, and like one of my very first 4-step was a searching and fearless moral inventory of everybody else in my life but me, because I didn't know how to look at me. I just didn't. I was the victim, and everybody was awful. And so I took that to my sponsor, and I blew that all out on her. And so my 5th step was just me telling her how horrible everybody else was, really. You know, I mean, I just didn't know how to do it any other way. And the irony was I spent a whole year not doing it because I wanted it to be perfect. And ultimately it was like the exact opposite of perfect, but it was perfect for me. And that's where my point is for everybody who hasn't done a 4-step, just do it. Just do it, because whatever you write down will be perfect. It's not being graded. It's what it's supposed to be the first time you do it, right? So she says to me after all that, I mean, it was bad. You know, my sister-in-law was a bitch and everybody was horrible. And she just looked at me afterwards, and she was like this tall, and she was so southern, and she said, nah, what a sad, angry, lonely little girl you are. I just thought, are you not listening to me? And then it just kind of sank in. It was like, oh, God, she's right. She's right. But that's the best piece of information I've ever gotten in this program. Best piece of information I've ever gotten. With somebody willing to love me enough, to not need me, she don't need me, but just love me enough to tell me the truth, because believe me, nobody else had the guts to say that to my face. And she did. And then I had something I could work on. See, then I understood why she had to be so brutal and honest. You gotta know what the problem is in order to fix it, right? So I went about trying to fix it. And at that point, I didn't really delve right into 6 and 7. I started having children. I have two children who I adore. My daughter will be 24 in January. My son will be, 22. And, you know, they're sober babies. They never seen me drunk. They're the light of my life. And, you know, as I said at the beginning, I'm an alcoholic, but I'm a mother, and I would not be a mother if I hadn't been an alcoholic, as ironic as that is. I might have been a mother, but I wouldn't have been the mother of those two, right? And I don't think I'd be the mother that I am, because I'd be wound tight still, because I was born wound tight. I had to learn how to unwind, and I wouldn't have found a way to unwind without this program. So, but eventually then I did another 4-step with another sponsor. I did another one, I think. I can't remember. But I ended up having all this list of things that were wrong with me. I remember going to the 9:30 meeting, which was my home group at the time, which was so great about NABA, because like the 5:45 worked when I was working. And then when I, you know, that laid off, I could go to the 9:30. And then when I had the children and was home with them all day, and my husband came home, I could go to the 8 o'clock. I mean, it was great. So I was going to the 9:30, it was my home group, and I was just recently sharing this in the meeting too, so sorry if you're bored with it, but I said, okay, I have this list of things that are wrong with me. What do I do? Do I just stop doing them? I mean, I don't know how to do this. Do I just stop doing it? And everyone's like shaking their head. Yes, you just stop doing all that. And Paul McGee was so sweet. He shared that, you know, you have to prove to yourself that you can change. You have to do these things and change things about yourself, and pointed out how, you know, really rigid I am in my thinking. But I knew that one of the things, okay, this one has not gone. I mean, I'm going to be honest with you. I've been working on this since forever. I am a huge control freak. And, you know, I'm the kind of person that if I have, like, you know, something in my teeth, I want you to tell me. I want to know. I want you to tell me. But my husband does not want to be told these things, right? He finds it controlling, right? It's really hard to be around people like that because you really want to tell them that something's wrong with them, right? So anyway, that night after I said, what do I do? How do I get rid of these things? My husband and I are sitting there eating dinner, and I look up, and he has salad dressing right here on his face. And I'm like, oh, my God, I can't tell him. He has salad dressing on his face. I literally had to get up and go to the laundry room and say a prayer about that salad dressing, because I just want to reach across the table and smack it off of him. You know what I mean? Because that's who I am. I can't tell you that it's been fixed. I'm telling you right now it's not been fixed, but I know that it's a problem. And so I didn't say anything. And the next morning I go to my 9:30. I am so proud of myself. I'm telling everybody, like, I didn't say anything. And I said, so I have no idea where the salad dressing is. And this woman goes, it's on the pillowcase. I went, oh, God, no, don't tell me that. Don't tell me that. So anyway, that's who I am. I try really hard to see where I'm wrong. And so when I got to 6 and 7, oh, God, God has such a great sense of humor. He showed me everywhere. He showed me everywhere. And somewhere in our book, it talks about how God will discipline us. And it doesn't mean he beat us up. It means he will show us how to become a better person, right? And I'll tell you this story because it really leads, I think, so much into how, you know, I really believe that when I was drinking, like, every hangover was God trying to get my attention. You know, every debacle was God trying to get my attention and me not doing it and not doing it and not doing it. And I think he does that with our character defects too, right? Start off small, you don't do anything about it, don't do anything about it. And then he has to really show it to us, right? It's not because he's mad at us or hates us, it's because he's trying to get our attention, right? So my kids were little, my husband was working off of Cheshire Bridge, and I was staying home with the kids now, so we said we will go meet Daddy at McDonald's on Cheshire Bridge for lunch, right? So Beau is probably 2, 2 and a half, and Grace is therefore 3, almost 4. And so we are there, and we're there in the ball pit out in the little, it was back when they had an outdoor patio and everything, and Beau's wearing rental socks, and he steps on a ketchup packet. A little, he steps on one, and now there's ketchup all over his sock and all over everything. And I am, what? Not happy about it, right? Mom, I'm not happy about the ketchup on the sock. And I'm like, God, you know, I mean, it's a little 25-cent sock or whatever. Making a big deal, acting like it's acid, right? And so all of a sudden in the distance, I hear sirens, you know, and you know little boys and sirens, they love them, right? So I suddenly switch gears. I pick up Bo and I go, Bo, it's a siren. And I'm holding him, of course, I'm holding him like this, like, don't touch me with the sock. But here it's exciting, but don't touch me, right? And holding him, and he's like, catching his feet. And I'm holding him, and here comes down to Cheshire Bridge. And, oh, it's an ambulance. It's an ambulance. And he's like, ah, ambulance. And it comes past me, got my kids, don't touch me. It says, Grady Neonatal Unit on the side of the ambulance. Grady Neonatal Unit. I burst into tears. I knew God was saying to me, knock it off about the stupid ketchup. That's what he was saying to me. And I still get chills thinking about that. That was the biggest, I know God doesn't really give you a bitch slap, but he really gave me a bitch slap. I mean, he really did. He needed to get my attention, and he did. And, you know, I could go on forever. You guys know I love this program. I love the steps. I love how my life has changed because of him. And, you know, yes, I did an 8 and 9. Some of them I've done all the kinds of 8s and 9s you can do. I did not have to do a graveside amends, thank God. But, you know, I've called old boyfriends. It didn't, it was humiliating. And I've done all the things that you can do to get comfortable in your own skin, right? And that's what those steps did for me. And then 10, 11, and 12, they keep me sober. And I do as much service work as I can. I have sponsees. I do miss them. I can't really let them into my home right now. I can't really be with them all the time, but I do try to see them in meetings and try to talk to them as often as I can on the phone. And some of them are willing to go to in-person meetings and some of them aren't, but it doesn't really matter. They are the light of my life. And like I said, you know, I'm an alcoholic, but I have a whole full life. I have so many other definitions of who I am because I was an alcoholic, because I needed to be to get to where I am right now. And so I do understand why people say they're a grateful recovering alcoholic, and I am one. And I'm grateful to all of you for putting up with the backup speaker. Thanks.
Outstanding. Outstanding. Way to go, Julie. You know, the first year in Alcoholics Anonymous, they say don't make any major changes. But if you're an alcoholic in your first year of marriage, it's probably a good idea to get sober and come to AA your first year. Way to go. That's a great story. I'm going to unmute some folks and everybody chat a little bit. And I'm going to...
Yeah, I want to see the pictures. I have my glasses on, Julie. I missed them. Oh, my God. I love it. Happy girl.
Julie. Julie.
I'm already being announced at 2.5 hours later.
Those photos that you showed at the beginning, I was on gallery view. Yeah, yeah.
Wow. I mean, 30 minutes later, I'm already just like the happiest human being on the planet.
Oh, girl, what I love, love, love your story. You told it beautifully. What always impressed me, you were always the smartest one in the room. And you were not, I admired your outspokenness because, you know, I was raised in the silent generation, or at least that was what I was born into. But you're a marvel, you're a miracle, and I just admire you so much and love you so much. And you did a great, great job of expressing your story. Just
thank you.
Thank you.
Love you.
Great job, Julie. I never heard your story. It was so good to hear it.
Thank you, Patty.
Loved it. It was great. Thank you, Julie.
Thank you.
I'm glad I tuned in. My lucky day.
Thank you.
It was a mess-a-log.
I was a mess, for sure.
It's hard to imagine you like that. You're so nice now. It's hard to imagine some of that stuff.
You didn't want to hear. She knows. She can tell me I was lying. She's the one who can say she's lying. That didn't happen.
Julie, I don't know whether I thank you or not, but your story put me back. I don't have a lot of things to, you know, biggies to tell, but your story put me right back to a place in my hometown in a time that was pretty awful. So, you know, it brought me up short, maybe more honest with myself. So thank you. Thank you for sharing.
Yeah, alcoholism is about how you feel. It's not about what you did. Mm-hmm. Okay. Tim, it's 8 o'clock. Or it's 9 o'clock. People want to go.
Okay, well, I'm going to offer chips because I know we have one celebrant at least. Anybody need a white chip? 30-day? 90-day? 6 months? 9 months, and a year or more.
Y'all
Paul just saw me do this, so I'm Patty. I'm an alcoholic. I still have 23 years of drunk in an hour between meetings. So, yay, what a coup. But thanks, y'all, for being part of my recovery.
Congratulations, Patty. And, yes, you do not look like an old timer. None of the ladies here look like old timers.
First I slept and then I crept to a hope-filled dream. You rescued me and finally waking there I see. I look into love's window for a soul that's meant for me. Takes me where the promises are real. Sometimes quickly, sometimes slow, we get just what we need. On a broad highway, stride for stride, we walk eternally. I look into love's window for a heart. Takes me where the promises are real. And I always long for something that set me free. Take me where the promise is.